Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we're going to be discussing the constitutional change in Togo from presidency to parliamentary system of governance by the current president, President Faure Gnassingbé, and the protests that has ensued from there. I'm joined by a special guest, Vincent Omowa Okangi, an international relations expert and analyst, and a social science researcher that is based, who lectures in Pioneer International University in the city of Nairobi in Kenya. Vincent, it's a pleasure of mine to have you join me today, and I look forward to our conversation.
It's my pleasure to join in this episode. I also look forward to a good time and a great interview.
Brilliant. So let's start off. So I think it should be in May 6th last year, 2024. There was a change in the Togolese constitution where that signaled a shift from a presidential system to a parliamentary system. So let's start off. Give us an overview of a background to what led to that change and what implication that has.
So let me give a brief background, the historical background for Togo, so that we can understand the situation in Togo and why the constitutional changes are sparking the protests that they are sparking. So Congo, Togo is a country in West Africa, which is initially colonized by Germany, but after World War I, the colonization shifted to France. Mm. And then later in 1960, Togo became independent under the presidency of Silvanus Olympio at that particular time. Who exercised power for 3 years, from 1960 to 1963, before he was assassinated, before he was toppled from power in a military coup that was led by Yasimbe Eyedema and other, alongside other military officials who are not pleased with the regime. Then the military installed Nicholas, who was also installed in 1963, and exercised his authority until 1967, when he was also overthrown by Iyadema Yasimbe. So Iyadema Yasimbe then established himself as a political ruler and a president from 1967, and it would go on to rule the country for nearly 38 years until in 2005, when he passed on. Mm. And when he passed on, the Togolese thought that there would be a change in as far as the political leadership of the country is concerned, but that did not happen. The military again installed the son, who is now Faure Gnassingbé, after his father's death. And then following the pressure from the citizens and the international actors. There was an organized election in 2005, which Faure is won, and 2010, 15, and 2020. So when you look at it cumulatively, you can argue that Togo has been ruled by the Kinyasimbe family for a period of more than 5 decades. And that is the genesis of all these protests that you are seeing. There is a belief that the family has exercised a firm grip on power, allowing a very small population of the Togolese to enjoy, and most of the benefits have been extended to the royalists and also to the military officers and the immediate family at the expense of majority of the Togolese population. This can also be interpreted in alongside the strongman rule in Africa, where when you see most of the African states, most of them have been led for many years by strongman rulers. And mostly, these strongman rulers have prioritized political survival at the expense of economic reform. And as the world has turned out to be more liberal in terms of international trade, you realize that initial industries that were doing well in those regimes are now facing stiff competition from the outsiders, and therefore most of them are in decline mode. And because they are in decline mode, then there are serious challenges that are arising as far as that is concerned. So that is the brief background of this Togolese political arrangement that is now sparking protests. So what we need to understand is that there is a feeling that the Yasimbe family, which is one of the longest dynastic rule in Africa, has ruled Togo for more than 58 years. And in those years, the Togolese people feel like the change is not coming against the increasing challenges of the time.
Interesting. Very, very interesting. Thank you for that history lesson. And if we... You also kind of made parallel to other countries in Africa, which I'll come to in a minute. So let's go to the particular change from the parliamentary and from the presidential to the change in the constitution. What is the immediate motivation for that?
In 2019, there was a constitutional change that set a term limit. Now, this term limit was to allow Kinyasimbe manage the country until 2025. It set that year as a year which Kinyasimbe would exit the office. So under that term limit. But now there was a constitutional change that shifted the country's political system from a presidential system to a parliamentary system. It created something like a prime minister who was in charge of the Council of Ministers and then established a ceremonial president. And therefore, the feeling is that this president, who is the Council of Ministers, elected by parliament, is perceived as overthrowing the constitution in the sense that you are creating an executive office which is not elected by the public, which again the people view that this office will be occupied by Kinyasimbe, which in other words means that he will continue exercising his executive authority as far as the Togolese state is concerned, and then you will have a ceremonial president who is not exercising any executive order, who is elected by the people but not able to check on the strong executive presidency of the Council of Ministers. So the feeling from the people is that this is a continuation of a regime that they would have wished to let go in the 2025, as it was set in the constitutional amendment of 2019.
Can you clarify something? So yes. The president is going to be ceremonial, and it is going to be the prime minister. So, but there's something you said. So has Yasimbe himself, Fahore Yasimbe, is he going to be the ceremonial president?
From the look of things, is that the constitutional amendment that has been done to shift the country from the presidency to the parliamentary system, majority of the analysts and the experts view that as a move that is seeking to create an executive position for Fahore Nyasimbe, who will be now the new president of the Council of Ministers, a post which is not subjective to election. And creating a ceremonial presidency who will be elected means that the people's preferred candidate will be very ceremonial against a council of ministers president who will be Nyasimbe, who will continue exercising his executive powers. And therefore, the president will actually be there as a ceremonial figure, but not exercising the authority.
That makes sense. That makes sense. Thanks for the clarification. That makes sense. We've seen, we'll come back to Togo. Okay, let's stay let's stay with Togo for a while. And then before we go to how the parallels across the different African countries in Gabon and other places. Let's stay with Togo for a while. How has the Togolese populace and the civil society, the opposition, how have they responded to this change?
The civil society and the Togolese population have not received these changes in good faith because there is a feeling, it's almost obvious, that the new change is set to extend Nyasimbe's rule against the feeling of the majority of the Togolese people who feel like his reign should have ended in 2025 and then pave way for another person.
Interesting. So how, in practical terms, how has the people reacted?
In practical terms, the people have reacted through protests. We have seen in the recent past, there was a massive protest in Lome to challenge this constitutional change. And because of the protests, there has been also a strong crackdown from the government, where there is massive use of force, and arrests and some killings have also been recorded in that light. But then the bottom line is that the citizens have risen up in arms protesting against this constitutional change, which they feel is a continuation of a dynastic rule.
Interestingly, so let's extend this to make some parallels. But interestingly, we've seen that in most of the countries in Africa, Togo, Kenya, Nigeria, and all these places, we've seen where the opposition parties that are supposed to be play the role of the opposition have been stifled. We saw in Mozambique, we saw in other places where the youth are taking. Recently, we've seen the youth in Kenya, they received the clash with the police against the tax bill. We have seen that these are youth-led. We saw in Nigeria the NSAS protest. Can you explain the dynamics where the traditional oppositions, the trade unions, the opposition parties are not able to present formidable opposition, whereas it's now the new generation, the youth, that are taking up this mantle? And can you speak to that and speak to how effective that has been?
So I'll speak to that, and I will draw a parallel from a number of countries. The opposition politics, as it is in Africa, has not been effective as far as pushing for change is concerned. Okay, in the fight for multi-party politics, they were efficient. But in the modern time, when we are trying to transition from political struggles to economic struggles, most of these opposition parties have not been effective. This is because most of these political parties have been infiltrated by the government forces. In cases where the opposition leaders are maintaining hard stand, most of them have been co-opted in government and then neutralized from within. For example, in the case of Kenya, we have the ODM party as the opposition party with majority of the seats. But what happened in late last year, following the youth protest, there was a handshake between the opposition leader and the president. And as things stand, the opposition leader is very much in support of the president. And therefore, in that kind of a situation, you find an opposition leader who is not able to rally the people to reject some of the repressive policies by the government. And as a result of that, majority of the young people are losing faith in this structured politics, and therefore they are resorting to exercising direct democracy, where they petition their interests through demonstrations in the streets and also using other forums, which they feel their voice can be heard. And that is the reason. When you look at, for example, in the case of Uganda, where the regime has very much power, the opposition is not able to break even from the repressive tendencies of the regime. And routinely, they are faced with crackdowns. And therefore, in those crackdowns, with the house arrest and with the harassment, it is not possible for one opposition leader to take on the government. And therefore, the youths are stepping up to fill that void in exercising direct democracy through street protests. And you can see that there is an increasing preference of the youths taking to the streets and directly prosecuting their case against the regimes that they feel are not responding to their interests.
Mm. Okay, let's stay. Can you hear me? Let's stay on the youth for a minute. And we see the lack of opportunities or platform, you know, more structural platforms or more to respond to the streets that are taking to dissent or protest. How effective do you think these approaches? Can you hear me?
I think this approach is very effective. You have many people that are pouring into the streets. You cannot just not be able to crack down on them because there are many, unlike in opposition, where arrest the leaders, harass them, and kill the movement. This round, if they are the number of youths are in the streets, then you are not able to crack down on them. Neither are you able to enroll. For instance, in the case of Kenya, during the 2024 protests, when the youths stormed the parliament, the government took it serious because after a day or two, the president dissolves the entire cabinet. For a moment, it appeared that this was very effective, but later on, the government has learned how to go around this youths, and then we have seen this protest again fizzling out. But I can say They are very effective. They are very efficient, because now this is an organic movement without a clear leader. And therefore, there is no way you are able to harass a few people here and there and suppress the movement. And then you are not able to tame the message. Even though in Kenya, the protests, the street protests have toned down, there is an increase in as far as the political awareness is concerned, online campaigns, also in civic education. Most people are becoming aware on what is happening in the political circles. They are understanding how government policies are shaping their future. And there are now more people that are joining in political debates than it was during that time. And so I think, apart from presenting the cases to the leadership and trying to push for some change, the fact that these movements are also enlightening most of the population as far as their civil rights are concerned, as far as the role of the government is concerned, and also highlighting the evils within the government, then we are increasing a number of people who are politically aware. And that means even when it will come to voting, we are likely to see an improvement as far as the quality of elected leaders are concerned.
I'm happy you said that, because you mentioned quite a number of things that aligns with my view. Number one, what we're seeing with the youth is, you mentioned, I like the way you put it, there's a shift from political struggles, which in my own terms would be the political parties that emerged. We saw in Botswana the paradigmatic shift from the Botswana party that has been there since independence, and that shift now. We'll see that the youth now, the under 25, most of these youth, are far removed from that post-colonial, anti-colonial, anti-independent, or independent struggle. So you call it political struggle, and then there's the struggle for economic struggle. The youth don't have opportunity, social mobility, and all of that, and they are far removed from that. So they are dealing with immediate stuff. Now, but there's something else you mentioned that's also interesting as well, is now we've seen where in other places, I don't know whether you're using the case of Kenya, maybe that case of Kenya can be a case study or be an example where there's that transition from street violence, street protest. And good thing, again, you mentioned the decentralized nature of this protest that is kind of confounding the status quo. But now is that transitioning from street protest into a very organized forum that can actually lead to the change, or even youth having places of power. So we see in Nepal, we saw what happened in Nepal recently, where the people stormed the house and all of that. And without a follow, we saw also the Arab Spring. Without a structured goal, usually those things fizzle out. And then the status quo, like you said, in Kenya, they learn, the leaders, they're very, very smart. They find a way to cover those gaps and come. So how do the youth, how do these protesters, or this, how can they, you've mentioned some, I like how you mentioned the civic education being organized. How can they effectively transition from protest, from, you know, challenging, to having a structured, not just resistance movement now, but a structured response and challenge and changing of the status quo? How can they really, really do that transition from there to something that is more organic, more structured, and far more effective?
What I would say concerning that line is that protests alone are not going to be the answers to the problems that we have. What is going to happen is that in as far as these protests are supposed to go on, because we need to keep on pointing the evils that are being committed within government and outside government, there is now a need for the youths to become politically aware. First and foremost, we need to increase our political awareness among the youths. We need to socialize them into different kind of politics, which is more of the politics of development. We need to fight, enlist a number of youths in shunning the politics of tribalism, which have sustained the first generation of the African leaders, especially those who fought for independence. They went ahead to form their own political parties. Those political parties are dominated by these elites, and therefore, in most cases, the youths do not have enough space as far as these parties are concerned. So we need to have political parties that are led by the youths. The youths need to come out, run for political offices, and also the youths need to also they need to stop being used as agents of violence in political rallies and political periods, so that they can engage in a structured political discourse that is likely to bring us a new breed of leaders that are going to take Africa to the next level. When you look at the case of Tanzania, for example, under the Chama cha Mapinduzi, which has exercised political leadership since independence, you realize that mostly the youth do not have much space as far as the organization within Chama cha Mapinduzi is concerned. Of course, in these organizations, you'll have things you hear of the Youth League. But when you examine that Youth League, you realize in most cases, it is a wing that is created to legitimize the actions of the elites and also to drum up support for the elites and not necessarily to drum up landscape of those. So that is the paradox where they paint a picture that the African youths are represented in the leading political parties, but then their role is not outstanding. Their role is to drum up support for the already established political elites in those organizations. When you look at the ANC in South Africa, that's the reason as why this Julius Malema had to break away from ANC and form his own party, Economic Freedom Party. Yes, because he felt like the youths within ANC are not allowed to play an outstanding role. They might not ascend to leadership, and they may also not be able to inform the policies that are going to be implemented by the ruling elites.
I agree with you 100%, very, very 100%. And again, I've seen it in my studies as well, where surprisingly, some of the youths have been used to, unfortunately, legitimize the status quo, legitimize the unfortunate leadership structure that we have in the country and the instruments. They've been instrumentalized for violence. But now let's look at the state level and do another comparison or parallel. We've seen in Africa, so we saw in Nigeria in 2006, I think, where the president wanted to extend his term beyond the constitutional provision for two terms to three terms. We've seen it in other places. We're seeing it in Ivory Coast now, where there's been constitutional engineering. We see the president decided to run again in October. This is going to be the fourth term, changing of constitution. We've seen it in Angola. We've seen in Rwanda. I've seen it in all of these places. So I wanted to look at it, and also we've seen Cameroon. What's going on? Cameroon also is having an election this year as well.
Yes,
actually. I wanted to look at this and see, is there a problem with our adoption of liberal democracy in Africa or multi-party democracy? Africa is the problem that Africa has not find its own system that works for it? Is African banned by, also look at the strongman politics and all that. Is that our nature? Is that the nature? Is that the nature of African system? Are we reflecting the nature in Africa? Or are we a victim of the system that we've adopted from the former colonial masters?
Yes, I would answer that question in two ways. The first one is that the concept of statehood is not a concept that originated in Africa. This is a concept that came with colonization. And colonization marked the beginning of statehood in Africa. And when you look at how the colonization established themselves in Africa, the kind of methods that they used to remain in power are the same methods that were adopted by the early generation of the African leaders after independence. And therefore, partly, I can say that statehood as a basis for political organization is a concept that has not worked so well for Africa. The establishment of political parties and how political parties need to be managed has not effectively worked for Africa. And the reason for that is because statehood has been is the basis for the allocation of the resources. And therefore, everybody wants to ascend to political power so that they can influence the allocation of resources. And that's why the elections in Africa are bitterly fought. And because of that basis, there is a deliberate attempt and effort to make sure that the institutions in Africa are not working as they should work. Because when you try to imagine democracy, we have a situation where institutions need to work the way they should work for democracy to be felt. For instance, the executive needs to implement the laws. Parliament needs to make the laws, and the judiciary needs to implement the laws. But when you look at the case of Africa, because of this strong executive and strongman rule, the executive has dominated. Parliament has also infiltrated the judiciary. And therefore, the separation, the concept of the separation of powers, it is almost not felt in most of the African states, where you find that the wish of the executive is what is going to carry the day and not exactly what is good for democracy. And that has been a reason as to why we have struggled with multi-party politics. Again, as a colonial legacy, the implementation of tribalism, the politics of tribalism, which is, I think, a legacy of colonization. Because when you look at the methods that were used by the colonial powers to acquire colonies in Africa, you realize that divide and rule was a method that was adopted. And this divide and rule method, which was adopted by the colonialists, didn't live after Africans became gained independence. Most of the African leaders that took power in trying to remain in power, trying to make sure that their regimes survive, also adopted the same. And in this case, they weaponized the aspect of tribalism so that they are able to be to sustain themselves in power. So you look at major tribes within Africa and the voting patterns, you realize that most of the leaders have come from major tribes. And those small tribes that have not had a chance to rule and cannot see a possibility of peacefully ascending to power have been left with an option of retreating to a given corner of the country and starting an insurrection movement, an insurgency. We can see that in the northeastern part of Congo, where the M23 forces are trying to handle themselves and see how they can take away that region from DRC because of this kind of marginalization. And therefore, because of this entrenched strongman politics and the ineffectiveness of the institutions, the political parties that have come have not been able to exercise or move us closer to the concept of democracy as envisioned in as far as the democratic ideals are concerned.
Before I come to the last question, okay, before, oh, were you going to say something?
So I would say that, but then, Dr. Michael, we cannot keep on lamenting over the past, because historically, the colonization of Africa happened, and we cannot reverse it. And therefore, we need to now bear with what we have and work with what we have and see how to improve it. And therefore, the Africans themselves are also part to blame for this kind of politics that we have been treated with. Because when you look at even the voting, most of the people have decided, have not developed an urge to understand politics, have not developed an urge to participate in politics, and deliberately choose good leaders. And as a result of that, the Africans themselves have perpetuated this narrative of bad leadership by recycling political leaders that have not been effective as far as the betterment of the people is concerned. A good case point is Malawi went to the polls on Tuesday. We are expecting the results either today or tomorrow, but I think today. But from the look of things, the Malawi presidential election attracted 17 candidates. And out of those 17, you have two former presidents and one an incumbent. And then when you look at the front runners, as far as this election is concerned, you realize it is the incumbent, Chakwera, and also the former president, Peter Mutharika. Actually, the existing those people who are trying to make the polls, trying to analyze them, are projecting that Peter Mutharika, at 85 years, is likely to storm again back to power. But you see, Peter Mutharika was once a president and did not eliminate the evils that he is condemning in the political rallies, yet the people have gone ahead again to reward him with another term. So you see, us also as Africans, we need to blame ourselves for allowing our countries to be run the way they are run.
It seems like we did, by the way, we did an episode on the potential return of Peter Mutharika. You could check out, I think this is some episodes back. We did it sometime last year when they started doing contesting for it. And the way you're talking, it looks like as if you read my last book when I was looking at Nigeria's new democratic dispensation since 1999, looking at the militarized democracy. We are talking about the colonial legacies, the politicization of ethnicity, how they've as the colonial legacy, and how the leaders in Africa has perfected that craft, and you know these things. So there's, I see so much alignment in your thoughts and mine. Now, before I ask the last question, just 2 minutes, just answer this briefly, and then we can go to the last question. What is the alternative? What alternative should Africa, besides multi-party system, the liberal system that we've adopted? I like how you said we can't reverse the history. It's our history. It's part of it. So, but is there an alternative that is going to be suited to the African setting and that can yield at least some significant standard of living to the people?
According to me, because we are already in the state system, the only alternative that we have is to make sure that institutions work as they should work in a democracy. If it is the executive, we need to make sure the executive executes its mandate in as far as the constitution is concerned. Then we have an independent legislature, which is also able to oversight the executive, and then a bold judiciary that can implement the constitution as it is. If we get it right in those three institutions, then we'll be able to exercise this democracy, and then multi-party politics will work. The reason as to why this multi-party politics has not worked, according to me, is because we have not built the institutions. And I can explain this from the case of America. During the 2020 handover, Donald Trump did not go to handover power. But in the American Constitution is that on January 20th, at exactly noon, the incumbent will automatically become the president. But in the case of Africa, that's not the case. So it means that in America, you cannot cling to power because the institutions, once the election is announced and a winner is known, they quickly move and they assume the roles they should assume as far as the handing over and everything is concerned. That's very different from Africa. And our biggest problem is that the legislature is heavily controlled by the executive because the legislature is the heartbeat of a democracy. It is the legislature that can oversee the judiciary and can also even fire the president. But you see, when these constitutional coups are taking place, they are actually taking place in parliament. So the strongman rulers in Africa have known the secret. Control parliament, and then you have everything. So for me, the highway to constitutional democracy in Africa is strengthening the democratic institutions in Africa, making sure that the concept of the separation of power is effective, and making sure that all of us live under the rule of law.
Okay, so lastly, once again, your ideas aligns with my views as well. Lastly, where do you see all of this stuff happening in Togo? What is your projection in terms of? Do you think Faru will be able to entrench himself in power like his father? Do you think he's going to be like the dynasties we've seen in the Gabon with the Bongo family? Do you think it's the same thing we've seen in Chad with what is his name, taking over power from his father? We also saw it in Congo as well. What is your projection?
My projection in this is that we may take time before we realize the fruits of this protest, the fact that these protests have started, it indicates that the people are aware of what is happening. And therefore, I don't think that he is going to entrench himself in as much as the father entrenched himself.
Interestingly. Vincent, it's been an amazing time. I really, really enjoyed this conversation. It's so rich and insightful. You and I have similar ideas of how to, so I'll reach out to you and we see how to do stuff together, how to move forward.
Future collaborations, I'm open as far as we are advancing the African dream so that we one day can live in a better continent.
But there's no other way to end this episode but on that note. Have a very great day.
Thank you very much for reaching out to me and for this conversation that we have had. I believe this is a good platform for us to share ideas which can influence other people so that all of us are reading from the same page in as far as the African tribulations are concerned, and future opportunities and prospects and the way to attain them. So that we continue pushing for this change. We are not doing that badly, but we need to keep on pushing so that we get to where we need to get.
I agree 100%. Thank you very much, Vincent, and have a blessed day.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your time. Have a blessed day
too. You too. Thank you for tuning in today. And as usual, join me to thank our guest, Vincent Okangi, for what I believe it's a very interesting conversation on the situation in Togo and how that also reflects on the wider issue of democracy in Africa. For now, stay blessed, and I'll see you next week.